Hey, what's going on? Greetings and good day, and welcome to the post-winter meetings edition of Birds All Day. We are coming to you live from not Las Vegas, unfortunately, and nor were we at any point this week in Las Vegas, but we will sum up all of the exciting stuff. The Blue Jays, very active in Las Vegas. It's not that they weren't active. They were about as active as anyone could realistically expect the Blue Jays to be here at the tail end of 2018, looking ahead to the 2019 season. I would just say they did nothing. Addition by subtraction seems to be the Shapiro mantra, I think. I don't think that's unfair to say. So with that out of the way, we should go right now, immediately, to, you know, the ghost, the angel on both of Mark Shapiro's shoulders. In fact, you know him as always.
Old Reliable.
Yes, as always, Mr. Andrew Stoughton. Stoughton, how are you?
I'm doing good. I just, you know, there's a lot of opportunities that are out there, and we're just waiting for some of those opportunities to coalesce into trades. Will it be today? Will it be tomorrow? I don't know. But what productive winter meetings we had in the suite there.
I'm glad. I hope that you had a nice time. I hope you found time to get your steps in, which I don't think is usually a challenge in Las Vegas. Maybe you're like the author of Positively Fifth Street, which is a great story about a great book about Las Vegas, the dying days of old Las Vegas, where the author used to swim in the rooftop pool every day. Is that how you would approach your time in Vegas? Were you, really working the texts, working the phones when you were there?
Well, you know, there was the reception was poor in certain areas. It was it was fun to watch the millennials have to actually walk around. I just stood at my stand-up desk for most of the time and laughed at them.
James McManus.
Sorry, yeah, James McManus.
He wrote Positivity History, which is good. It's an interesting story. But he's a writer who went in the World Series Poker Main Event, made a run, but is also writing about like this kind of crime-soaked family. There's a murder trial in Las Vegas that's going on. Interesting. And he swims every day in the pool when he's in the main event, at the rooftop pool at Binion's, which is where they used to do the World Series. But they don't anymore. Was it Mandalay Bay?
Yeah, that's where it was. Yeah. Is Binion, did you say Binion's? Is it gone? Is that why they don't do the event there anymore?
No, it outgrew. It outgrew the Binion's. It was too big. And they used to do, so they moved it to the Rio All Suites Resort, which is actually off the strip. And Binion's is in old Las Vegas. Old downtown Vegas, which has a weird roof on it now, or has for many, many years. But Binion's is really super grimy, and it's kind of neat to go in there. I was there once, just because that's where they used to do the World Series, and I kind of poked my head, and there's some weird little plaques and stuff on the wall. But now the main event of the World Series of poker is like 7,000 people play in it, maybe 6,000 people. They do the day one takes like a week. They have to do rolling day ones because there's just so many people that are playing in a $10,000 poker tournament. But anyway.
Okay. You know, I don't know if I mentioned on the pod before or not. I probably have. But I was in Vegas as a kid. There was a time when they tried to make it like a family-friendly destination. Mm-hmm. And my sister would do like dance stuff. And there was like a national competition there, and went there a couple times. And it was like the fucking early 90s. Like, I remember like the sands and the dunes and like, mm-hmm. like the old, you know, in the years before they, just before they imploded them and built it up. And it's like now to look at pictures from, you know, from like Flamingo and the Strip, it's just so completely fucking unrecognizable. It's like nowhere else I could imagine. Like it was really quite bare at that point. And like you go and I'll you know, tool around on Google Maps and shit. And it's just the transformation. I mean, I'm not telling anything anybody doesn't already know, but it's so stark to look at it now. I haven't been back since like 1993, and a little bit different.
For me, the thing is the transition from those old style, like let's build the nicest kind of hotel that we can. That's still quite garish and obviously lots of neon lights. And then it went to the super themed places. Like I think Keegan Matheson was staying at the, what's it called? The one with all like the towers and, like, it looks like a castle.
Oh,
like,
the Excalibur. Yeah.
Yeah. Stayed at the Excalibur. And then there's the one.
Yeah. That was
Luxor, just like the pyramid. And then there's the New York. And And then now, but all the places that they've built recently are like the really, really high end, sleek condo style, like the Aria and Cosmo, and even the Wynn and the Encore, where they don't, they just look, they look nicer, and it's a place to go and spend a ton of money is what it is now. And they have all the high end shops and like Cartier and whatever, crazy stores that you don't find in the mall.
Yeah. I saw some of the chatter about the drink prices there. I think was it Grant Brisby took a picture and tweeted of his mini bar prices, which were, outrageous, as mini bars are, obviously are going to be. But I think, I think it seemed like Mandalay Bay was maybe not the easiest place to go get shit-faced if you're a reporter, which is obviously a very important part of the job.
If you're looking to get shit-faced in Vegas, just get like a few dollars though that you would spend on an expensive drink and like sit at a blackjack table or go play craps or roulette or just find somewhere to just, or even just go play poker, go sit in a 1-2 game and fold and drink for free until you've had your fill and then you go on your way. Because it is crazy how expensive things are in Vegas. You can find deals, you just have to get out of the hotel, yeah. Right? You can go to the CVS and you can get whatever you want. You can go to, there are lots of hot, nice, fancy restaurants, but there's also not amazing. There's a food court that's right in the middle of the strip where you can go get the sweet, sweet nectar of Del Taco and be happy and be on your way, having a great day. And then you go back out, you wander into the night, and you're like, "Where am I? How long have I been inside?" And you go get more Del Taco, and you go back and have some more fun. And you stand around the pool that's closed because it's the off season. So even though it's like 75 degrees Fahrenheit, right. You can't swim because the pool's closed because it's December.
Yeah, I feel like you probably couldn't pay me enough money to go to Las Vegas, but whatever. People like it, so cool.
I truthfully haven't been in a long time. I think if anyone really wants some good recommendations, you got to go to Remco, who listens to this podcast, who does tons of poker content and hosts two different podcasts on Poker Go, which is like a Poker Go app, and he's there doing huge cash games. Like covering them and doing interviews and doing all of his Poker Go stuff. So if you don't follow Remco, and he also talks to Stoughton about Ajax incessantly online because that's what it's for.
Not incessantly, but yeah.
Well, it's what you guys talk about, and Parks is even gets looped into it from time to time. And in a lot of ways, it's the beauty of online, because there's this random Dutch guy who lives in Toronto because that's where his wife is Canadian, and there's these tenuous links, and now we're like friends, and he can tell you where to go in Vegas if you need to know. Because Remco's got all the connects in the beautiful in Sin City. Now, speaking of Sin City, you know who else lives in Sin City? Not Remco. He's there about half the time, as far as it seems like. But Troy Tulowitzki has a home in Las Vegas, and he met with the Blue Jays. The stories began very ominously, where it's like, oh yeah, the Jays met with Tulo's agent, and Tulo wasn't there, but they expect to connect with him tomorrow. This was at the beginning of the week. Which was like, what do they think they're talking about there?
Yeah.
And as it turns out, they were talking about the release of Troy Tulowitzki with 2 years and an option year still remaining on his contract. The option, which has a $4 million buyout, which means that when the Blue Jays decided to release Troy Tulowitzki, they owed him $38 million. But now he's gone, a free agent, free to sign anywhere, free to get all the money that he earned and was owed to him. But no longer a member of the Toronto Blue Jays. A move that I think in a lot of ways makes sense, but still kind of surprising.
Yeah, people were surprised that it happened. I was surprised that it happened, because it just, it's walking away from a lot of money, which doesn't really seem to fit the Rogers Blue Jays MO. I know they did it with BJ Ryan many years ago. I know that Frank Thomas had an issue, which was a little bit different in that same sort of era. But yeah, that's... for a team that employed Kendrys Morales for April and May, and when he looked like he was fucking just completely finished, which of course didn't turn out to be correct. He had a pretty nice season, but yeah, it's felt like this isn't a team that is really looking to just piss money away and be the Boston Red Sox and be like, yeah, that's a terrible mistake. So yeah, it was a little bit surprising. I do like about it that people are like, what a waste of $38 million. It's like, I'm sorry, sir. It was $58 million because they paid him $20 million this year to do fuck all. And maybe $78 because they paid him $20 million the year before to do pretty much fuck all as well.
In 2016? No, 2017. No,
17, yeah.
Yeah, he didn't do a lot. No. He was quite bad.
So, yeah, a real, you know, it sucks that that's how the Tulowitzki as a Blue Jay conversation ends. As I mean, you wrote an amazing piece about it this week about what, you know, what a shining star he was.
It's true, and you hate to see any great athlete go out that way, both being unceremoniously released in December with still 2 years on his contract, but also watching him struggle, watching him, you know, age in real time, in like quick time, not even real time. But also, the, you know, and I was on the Expand Zone podcast with Jonah Birnbaum and Michael Bradburn, Michael. And yeah,
Bradford.
And the thing about Tulowitzki is like the injuries are a freak injury, and sure it. So on one hand, I'm very sympathetic because you know shit happens. Shit happens to Troy Tulowitzki, and it happened when he was here, and it happened when he was in Colorado. Colorado, you get hurt, and the injuries linger because you know just that playing at altitude, there is an increased risk. There are more soft tissue injuries that they just guys get hurt more playing there. But then he comes here, and then in 2015, it was like the shoulder blade crack when he collided with Kevin Pillar, where it's like, oh, it's a freak injury. Kevin Pillar runs into him, but it's like maybe another guy doesn't get injured to that degree with that.
Yeah.
And then the thing with the ankle when he in 2017 when he went down was when he stepped on CJ Krohn, who made one of the worst tags of the first base bag you'll ever see because he just sort of missed the base. And there's this one of the slowest everyday players, you know, on who's an infielder in baseball for sure, lumbering down the line. But Krohn is out there stabbing his foot around and gets his entire leg across the leading edge of the base. And that's what Tulowitzki steps on, which sucks. It's a terrible kind of random quirky injury, but also maybe it doesn't knock every other player out for a year and a half. So it's tough. It's tough to see to such a great player, a shining star, as you said, a guy who in 2016 was actually pretty good. I mean, he wasn't 5-win, 170 weighted runs created plus Troy Tulowitzki that we saw in like 2014, but he was above average at the plate or close to average. He was still obviously above average in the field. He's a 3.5 win player in 120 games.
Well, that was the year where, you know, we were writing the obituaries in April for him as well. It looked like he couldn't catch up to the fastball, and it looked, you know, I think Dave Cameron wrote a piece, and it was like really exactly at that moment in that season where he kind of turned it around because it looked like he was washed. It looked like, this Tulo thing might not be going so well. And then he turned it around and you know, looked fine, looked serviceable and better than that. Yeah, like you say, like three and a half wins in 120 games or whatever it was. I mean, the defense at shortstop, like it's never going to be explosive looking, but it was great. He was a steady, sure hand, and you know, had he continued to be that player and maybe, you know, got a little bit of the bat back, as you know, it doesn't always just drop off a cliff, right? I mean, Kendrys Morales this year, we saw him bounce back at an advanced age and look quite a lot better than he did the year before. You know, there was genuine hope, and I think you're absolutely right about the injuries being, you know, freak injuries that are maybe not so freak injuries because it just keeps happening, and I don't know how much to take seriously Atkins' comments about, you know, how candidly, you know, he'd say himself like he'd have to really overachieve to be an above average shortstop for 140 games, but I mean, I think that's obviously true. You got to think that they're looking at it though and thinking it's just so much worse than that. I mean, having to take a year and a half off when you were already looking at times like, this is a guy who's just can't hang anymore. That's probably not going to work out great. I would love it if it did. It'd be nice. I don't think Jays fans should have any, you know, ill will towards the team if he pops up somewhere else and has a dead cat bounce or you know, has more left in the tank and manages to stay injury free. I think the writing was on the wall, and the fact that it would have been such a sideshow in spring training and when they're really trying to, you know, build a culture and team unity and try to be, you know, this new thing and usher in a new era and really make a point of that with the new manager and lots of young players and trying to create this culture that isn't looking to you know, the guys who are no longer here, the Donaldsons, the Bautistas, the Tulitskis, and that would have been a mess, and it probably would have ended up in the same result, but just with a worse one for Tulo, because he would have had less of a chance to try to catch on somewhere. So, you know, yeah, I get it. But
in some ways, it's almost, even if, I don't think there's any reason to believe that Tulowski would have been like a problem in terms of like a vocal, you know, going out of his way to make problems for the team. But it's definitely a headache that a new manager doesn't need coming in. Mm-hmm. And the value of that roster spot and the value of getting to see as much Lourdes Gurriel as is possible, even Richard Urania to an extent, with, you know, the understanding that Bo Bichette is on his way, that he's, you know, he has some things to prove at AAA, and then he'll have things to prove at the big leagues. But to be able to go in and say, like, these are the goals we have for that middle infield, this is what we hope to achieve, simply removing Tulowitzki and removing the possibility that Tulowitzki is fine-ish, because if Troy Tulowitzki is not even the above average to play above average in the field, that kind of low possibility or low probability outcome that Atkins referenced, but it doesn't help the 2019 Blue Jays if Tulowitzki is good, and if he does come with that dead cat bounce, who benefits from that realistically? It's not the difference between the team being good or bad. It's probably the difference between him being offering zero value and maybe like league average value.
Yeah.
Like if Tulowitzki comes out and puts it all together and plays, ends up playing 125 or capable of playing 125, 130 games, like it doesn't really advance the Blue Jays, you know, quote unquote cause that much, other than they might win another couple games.
Or they might be able to trade him for a guy they won't protect in the Rule 5 draft the next winter, right? Or so, you know.
Even that, I don't think there's any way, because that the same, like he, with the extra year, with the $4 million buyout on the end, just with the amount of money that he was owed, and the unlikelihood of him, A, bouncing back, and then B, being able to repeat it the coming year, he has no trade value whatsoever. To get rid of him, you're going to have to do essentially what they did now, even if he comes back and plays well, unfortunately. So it's in some ways it's a smart, difficult decision because of the amount of money that they've just, you know, thrown away. But that money was already, they were already in the act of throwing it away.
Yeah.
They've just now, you know, let their hands go, and it's now floating free. So again, it sucks, and I don't know. I'll ask you this, and I was asked this today, but what do you think is going to be Tulo's like legacy as a Blue Jay? Do you think fans are going to remember him fondly? Do you think they're going to remember the kind of synergistic role, like the way that he helped his defense and his shortstop play kind of fuse that 2015 team together? Or people are just going to remember him as a guy who got hurt and was hurt for 2 years and then got cut, paid to go away. I don't know. I'm a little skeptical of the former and more leaning towards the latter myself.
Yeah, I think it's somewhere in the middle. I mean, the name that popped into my head was like Ricky Henderson. It's because Henderson was here for that half a year in 93. And, you know, people remember him fondly because he was part of that thing. Maybe a touch extraneous, though, you know, wasn't, you know, somebody who was driving the bus on that team, but was an important addition that helped them get to where they needed to go. And I think Tulo was that. And then, I mean, this is the parallel stops because Tulo continued to play here. Henderson obviously didn't. And that Tulo was kind of valuable in 2016 when run prevention was like the big thing that the Jays, you know, suddenly their bats were not as great and everybody was just pitching out his ass and every fucking starter was ridiculously healthy and they pitched their way to the playoffs. So there's that about it, but it wasn't, you know, it was a bit of a nondescript year. It was just sort of like he was a steady hand, and then he sort of disappeared. So I think I don't know. I don't think people will at this point hold it too much against him what's happened here. I mean, it's not like a healthy Tulo was standing in the way of the Blue Jays being in the playoffs in 2017 or 18. I mean, there just was so much else that went wrong that you can't be like, oh, man, if we got those extra five wins from Tulo that we, you know, that he could have at one point in his career provided, you know, that would have made a huge difference. It was just, it ends up that it didn't really matter. And yeah, I don't know. I hope his legacy as a Blue Jay is that he was a great Colorado Rocky.
Yeah, I don't think that's untrue. I don't think that's unfair to say. I absolutely agree that in some ways it works to his advantage that he was hurt for so long, as opposed to being out there and like being really bad every day.
Being an Albert Pujols or something.
Or even being like Jose Reyes, right? Where it was just like, whoa, this is getting to be like a real problem that he's still out there playing. Tulowitzki's injury sort of helped that. And I think the ultimate, you know, the sign of the kind of blessing and curse and exactly the Troy Tulowitzki experience is the number one thing that everyone remembers and the thing that people are were sharing the most and their number one memory of Troy Tulowitzki's time as a Blue Jay was the day that they got him.
Yeah, absolutely, without question.
Because it made the whole thing seem real.
Yeah,
and it made the whole it was hope, and it was the kind of I said this on the other podcast today, but it was like it was the kind of thing that the Blue Jays just didn't do. The Blue Jays don't trade for Troy Tulowitzki. They don't make daring, massive moves for name players, for guys who have been in the conversation for the best players in the game for the better part of a decade. That just doesn't happen. But it did, and then it just set that whole thing in motion, and then followed up by the, oh, we just traded three prospects, two, one of them being like one of our top prospects for a rental starter who's also David Price. It never would have reached that like ratcheted up level of euphoria without the Tulowitzki thing. And no, so that's like the mental side of it. And the other side of it, and as you mentioned, is that, and that we all know that if they didn't make that move, if they were out there running around with Jose Reyes in 2015, that team is not what it was. And maybe they don't even get as far as they did. I mean, they still were going to score 1,000 runs. They were going to beat the snot out of everyone that maybe they ran through. But Reyes was a detriment. He was not going to help that team. And Tulowitzki did. And then, as you said, he was integral to the 2016 team. 2016, he played more games than he had in like 5 years as well. He was for Tulo, two DL trips, remarkably healthy. But I think you're right that hopefully people, you know, that feeling, he earned that, and his play for his career was the genesis of that feeling, and I hope that is something that people can hang on to. And then remember the moments that he had, again, playing great defense, hitting the home run in game three of the ALDS, and then hitting, I think he had a couple other home runs in the next series. I think he might have hit one of the only... did he hit a home run against Cleveland in 2016? I don't remember, but it seemed like he was one of the only guys who actually managed to swing the bat a little bit.
Other than Big Zeke, but yeah.
Yeah, that will be... How could we forget Big Zeke? Yeah. But anyway, so that's it. So now it's, you know, that's... We've said, oh, they need to make these decisions about Gurriel and maybe Urania, and obviously Bichette's coming. And then Ross Atkins like, well, maybe we'll have to get up and find a shortstop. Like, come on, man! The body is still warm. Like, you can't...
I mean, they probably could use some cover there, I suppose. But I mean, it's like somebody, you know, who they can maybe rely on, who isn't just like a ghost. And also, I don't know whose story it was. I don't know if it was Shai's piece, but somebody wrote about how, you know, when they went to Oakland and that was the last time Tulo visited them, that apparently there was a players only meeting, or there was a meeting in the clubhouse, and he was like addressing the team and talking about what needs to be done. And they were like, yeah, a lot of the new faces who weren't there in spring were like, who's this guy? Which I think, I don't know if I believe that characterization. I feel that most Major League Baseball players would recognize Troy Tulowitzki, for fuck's sakes, given, you know, was in the conversation for the best baseball player on the planet there for at least a couple of years. But that was interesting. What's also interesting to me is that, you know, both coming and going, just the reaction of idiots always fascinates me a bit. Like, because if you recall, when that trade did happen, as wonderful and as amazing as it was, there was definitely a strain of people who were like, well, they need pitching. What is this? They need to get pitching. What are they doing here? And there was a thought at the time even that he might be getting flipped for some pitching help, because that was really the issue. I think a lot of people at that point were like, oh, well, Ryan Goins, we can obviously just plug him in place of Jose Reyes. And then on the way out, I've seen people grumbling about the fact that immediately that he's unemployed, he's like, well, you know, maybe I'll play second base. The A's want me to play second base. Sure, I'd be open to that. And you know, some people really getting up in my mentions about how this obviously invalidates anything to do with his leadership. He was just angling for a move out of town, and then right away he turned his back. And it's like, Jesus Christ, people, figure out how the industry works a little bit. The guy who has employment and has that big paycheck has leverage to be like, no, I'm going to play shortstop, or you're going to just sit me and not pay me, or pay me anyway, I guess. Once you are actively looking for a team to put your carcass on a roster, that changes a little bit.
The selfish thing was the one I saw.
Yeah,
they were like, the one quote in taken in the wrong way. One perfect pull quote that serves the purposes that you need. Like if I'm either the shortstop or I'm not playing or whatever it was. It gets cut right to the core of what people really want to think and say about athletes. They love to call them selfish.
Yeah.
Willie Nylander is selfish. Troy Tulowitzki was selfish for saying that. They're not all about the team. They don't waive their no trade clauses because they're selfish. They most fans just don't have a key, hold players in high regard. They worship them, but also just really don't like them.
This reminds me, I don't know, I'm not trying to segue for you, but this reminds me of responses I was getting about Scott Boras, too, who fucking absolutely nailed Rogers and the Blue Jays on, you know, where the, you know, what the kind of questions they should be asking. And I tweeted yesterday about, you know, there's a quote in Shai Davidi's latest piece about it, or one from last night, where Boras is saying, like, yeah, you lost 30% of your fans. Maybe you should be thinking about how you're investing in this team that you've seen can be optimized and have 3.5 million people and huge TV ratings. Like, why are you not optimizing your franchise? And I think, you know, Shapiro and Atkins would probably argue that they are to the extent that they can. And, you know, what Boras said was, you know, we could talk about that, but I think it was a great quote that hit at Rogers and hit at, you know, exactly the things that Blue Jays fans have thought for a very long time about, you know, the way the ownership treats the team, which is, you know, as an asset and something that they're concerned about how it looks on their books, as opposed to something they want to really invest in fully and turn into a winner that, you know, down the line pays off maybe more, rather than looking short term about, you know, how it's going to affect their stock prices. And then you still, I said something nice about Scott Boras, so still people will, no matter what, be like, fuck that piece of shit, you know, don't listen to that, but he's just self-interested, fucking just looking out for himself. It's like, okay, I guess so. I guess you could just ignore exactly what he said and go ahead and hate him, but I think you're missing something.
There are an alarming number of teams in Major League Baseball that are operating in that exact way, though. There are a lot, yes, of teams that operate like a joke. The Pirates are going to have like a $75 million payroll this year. I believe before the Charlie Morton signing, the Rays were clocking in like below Zach Greinke. Like, Zach Greinke's going to make more money than the Rays are. The Marlins are absolutely operate like a complete joke. Like, Cleveland traded Edwin Encarnacion. They went through all these weird to save $4 million. Maybe it's just everybody, even the Red Sox. The Red Sox won the World Series. They spent their money, and now there are rumors that they are looking to move, you know, Rick Porcello or even Xander Bogaerts, because they got to bring their salary down, which is, you know, everyone's got a budget, but I mean, the Boras thing is really puzzling. I would be lying if I said I didn't used to be like, oh, you're the worst thing to happen to baseball when I was younger and
sure.
and less invested in and have a, with a lesser understanding of how the that industry works. But like, it's really odd. This the way that the people are. These teams are just going out of their way to not be better in a lot of different ways. But
yeah, I saw some good talk about this on Jay's Twitter. I forget who exactly was going on about it, but you know, it's a de facto salary cap, right? I mean, the Players Association has just been so. I can't believe Tony Clark kept his job. I can't believe that there wasn't more scrutiny about just how completely fucking screwed over the Players Association has become. I mean, I guess there's the guys who are making the money don't mind, but you know, not only is there essentially a salary cap now because of the way, you know, the draconian nature of the luxury tax and the fact that teams are just so disinclined to go over it for too long, and like you say, the Red Sox looking to cut salary to make sure they get back under, and always, you know, the Dodgers and the Yankees, the teams that could very comfortably spend above the luxury tax, most teams I think could, but those are ones we know absolutely could, still sort of dancing around it. And the point that people were making on Jay's Twitter is that, like, at least in other leagues where you get a salary cap, you also get a salary floor, and it's like it forces you know, the Atlanta Thrashers of the world to spend some fucking money, and it forces teams at the bottom to not do exactly what these other teams are. So baseball is not only, you know, nominally doesn't have a salary cap, but it does, and yet it doesn't have a floor. And so you have, like you say, Zach Greinke getting paid more than the fucking Rays, and it is it's absurd, especially when we know, you know, like what the TV deals are paying them. And what I think it's like it went up to $75 million a couple years ago, and now there's a new deal that's coming out, and then there's, you know, MLBAM money that comes in, and there's also, you know, there's all sorts of money that is well above where you know, the Pirates payroll is, that they're, you know, so they're making a ton of money by keeping their spending low and being like, all right, well, we're going to be bad-ish for a while. It's very strange. And then, you know, you talk about the, you know, Boris talking about the loss of attendance, and there's this move, and we've definitely seen it in Toronto. It's a big plank of what Shapiro is trying to do, but it's like, well, they don't even care about attendance. They care about premium revenue. You know, if the stadiums have full, but the seats that are full are the ones that are, you know, the fucking Bay Street people shelling out a ton of money, they're probably happy. I mean, we saw it last year when people were like, oh, the home opener usually sells out in seconds, and it's, you know, it isn't sold out yet. And I think the comment from the club was like, it's going to be the highest revenue home opener in club history. So they weren't really worried about it. And that ain't good either. I don't have a prescription to fix
thing,
it. Yeah.
I really think the attendance thing, again, the attendance doesn't drive it's not the main driver. It's not the main revenue source. It doesn't, when the player's salaries go up, the tickets prices don't go up. Anyone who still hangs on to that dream, let me know if the prices for tickets this year go down in Toronto, because they're not going to. The problem is that no one is going to want to pay premium dollars to watch a dog shit team. And you can like promise the world, and you have to build a winner if you want people to pay that money. And I guess that's the point, I guess, is like, if we do it right, we can charge big bucks for a team that's good and cheap, and then we're all laughing. But like, no one's going to be, you know, that Vlad Jr. is not going to be a driver of ticket sales. Once, when it's like, oh, Vlad Jr. is coming, this is the day, and then there'll be a bunch of dorks like us that'll go and buy tickets. But the Bay Street guys, they don't give a shit.
Yeah, no.
It's like, if they're not fans. Yeah. So, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. I think the attendance this year in Toronto is going to be brutal. But they've accounted for all of that. They know what they're doing, and it's not a major concern of theirs, I don't think. So they can get away with cutting it down, you know, stripping it back to the wood and saying things out loud, like, we really want to see what Richard Urania can do this year, because that, like, anyone gives a shit.
Yeah.
Like, maybe he can be an almost league average player. You never really know. And then if, as soon as he shows that, then we'll make sure we sign him to like a 5-year contract with three options on the end, just in case he has a million things come together and he is good. Like, no. But anyway, let's move on. Let's move on to more other cynical things that they can do, like draft a literal child in the Rule 5 draft.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
That is an interesting one. So what's his name? Lucky or Luciano or something like that?
Elvis Luciano.
Elvis Luciano, 18 years old, plucked from the Royals system, yeah. I believe.
Yeah, though he was in Arizona before. He was in the John Jay trade last summer.
Ah, yes, indeed. Scouting report from Ross Atkins via Keegan Matheson. A low 90s fastball, good feel for the breaking ball, good changeup, incredible delivery. The eye test is a very good one. It's got to be, because now he's 18 years old and he's on the 25-man roster until such point that he is not.
Yeah.
A little bit of a wild choice. Again, you got an 18-year-old that you're now hoping to carry through the entire, stick with the team all year.
It doesn't exactly jibe with the whole we're trying to win as many games as we can thing, does it? Because that's clearly not a move that a team that was real interested in winning would do. I mean, I think obviously there's in ways they're going to try to win, but yeah, it's they're gonna to keep him. They're gonna have to carry him the whole damn time. I mean, I guess they could work out a trade. So I saw somebody being like, oh, maybe they want a real close look at him in spring training, and it's like, well, I mean, maybe you could just fucking you could just trade for a guy if you. I don't know why that would be the strategy. It seems like they really want this guy in their organization. They seem to see something. It's I blame fucking Cistulli, frankly. But also, I mean, you'd hear about what they're, where things are going with like minor league TrackMan data. So like they've seen the spin rates, they've seen the movement. They have much more advanced information on these guys. So maybe that. Mm-hmm. That's something that I thought, okay, maybe that's driving their decision here. But it's still a fucking 18-year-old who I'm looking at Eric Longenhagen's piece on the Rule 5 selections, and it says scattershot command. It's like, well, okay, I mean, I guess if you want
to... That, to me, is exactly what you would need from a guy who's going to have to be on your roster all year.
Yeah. I mean, you can... Especially just the way that they churn through relievers so much these days, right? And how it's, your bullpen is like 15 guys deep. It's just half of them are at Buffalo at one point. There's going to be a ton of movement up and down. And I think that was probably a given anyway. But just to have that one, roster spot unusable for anybody else for a guy who you're only going to pitch in complete fucking blowouts is curious, but I guess they've weighed the cons against the pro of getting him into the system, and then a year from now, getting him into fucking Double A.
So, you were looking at Eric Longenhagen's scouting report. I'm on the baseball reference page of Willy Kenyatta.
Yeah?
Do you remember Willy Kenyatta? Do you know that name?
I certainly do know the name, yeah.
He was, of course... What? Indulge me, the listeners, via me.
Oh, God. You're going to ask me for specifics? I just remember.
Nothing super specific. So Willy Kenyatta was a Rule 5 guy that the Blue Jays carried on their roster in 1993 when the team was like ridiculously good. They won the World Series, you may remember.
Yes.
They also had like the ultimate set-it-and-forget-it lineup that they just ran the same guys out there every single day all year long. So because they were so good, because the lineup was full of guys who played every day, it was 25 years ago, so the demands on the 25 and 40-man roster weren't the same. So you, as a team that was good, could afford to have a guy sit there on your roster all year long to the point where you gave him, so he's a Rule 5 guy, has to be on the roster the whole time, he... had 57 plate appearances all year long. You can't do that, in 2018, when you're just cycling so many guys through and that roster spot is incredibly valuable, and B, when you're a team that's bad. when you're a team that's bad and even with the shorter DL, like it just makes it really, really tough to just hide a guy to squirrel him away in the corner of the roster. I can't see how that could work out unless you talk about all the TrackMan data, you talk about this and that. What if they know something that we don't? Such as his arm is going to break.
Right.
What if they know that he's going to need Tommy John, and that way they can stash him on the DL and then do like have him as a guy who can then go up and down?
Yeah, but they have to keep him on the roster for a certain amount of days, or he'll be under the same obligation next year with respect to, you know, having to be offered back to the Royals. I remember that was a thing when Glenn Sparkman. It was, you know, the Joe Biagini 2.0, who they ended up not keeping. But that was a thing because I think he broke his thumb or there was some sort of injury that he had that kept him off the roster for a little while, which was like, oh, okay, so this will make it easier for them to keep him around. But I forget what the cutoff is, but I think you do have to serve, you know, a number of days on the actual active roster rather than the DL. So, you know, that still could be at play, depending on when they think his arm might break or what, if that's really what's going on there. I think Manny Lee was also a guy like Kenyatta. I don't know if it was Shy or Benny Fresh. Somebody would mention that in a piece today that I was reading about how Manny Lee, whichever he prefers. Same thing. I think in 85, he was the Kenyatta and just sat on the bench and didn't do anything. And so the Jays won the AL East with, you know, playing with a 24-man roster, basically. But yeah, I don't know. They're not going to win the AL East this year anyway, so I guess we'll see. But the thing with the Rule 5 is, it turns out, especially when I guess the Jays have a bunch of guys who are going to be selected. They lost two guys, Travis Bergen and Jordan Romano today. It seems like the Rule 5 experts really start to come out of the woodwork. It's like a lot of people really think that the Jays have just completely bungled the whole thing. You know, they could have kept those two guys on your 40-man if you had just released Tulo sooner or Solarte sooner, which is not untrue, but I think misses some components of the way that roster spaces are allocated and the way that any of that shit works. But God love the experts for being out there trying to share their expertise.
We're lucky to have them, quite frankly. Just like the Blue Jays were lucky to have Manny Lee, who mm-hmm. Manny Lee was 20 when he was a Rule 5 guy. And how does it even work? How are you 18 and in the Rule 5 draft? Like,
well, it's a loophole, right? This guy had his first contract was voided for a health issue or something like that. And that has somehow ended up pushing him ahead in terms of like when he had to be protected. I'm not sure how that works exactly, but that apparently is the issue.
Manny Lee had 40 at bats, 43 plate appearances in 1985.
Yeah.
He had 40 at bats and he had 8 hits for what that's worth.
Stayed on the roster all year. And then ended up a success story. That's a great Rule 5 pick.
Not untrue. Not untrue at all. The Blue Jays lost Jordan Romano in the Rule 5 draft. Jordan Romano was drafted and then traded to Texas, yeah. I believe. He was lost to Texas. But yeah. But that's the other good story. A Canadian guy that has been a starter in the minor leagues. Maybe Texas will
which out of the bullpen. Which is, I think, you know, a Canadian guy, I think, is why maybe we hear more grumbling about that than we otherwise would. I mean, we're talking, these are Rule 5 picks. I mean, Joe Biagini was a smashing success as a Rule 5 pick. And he's like, you know, the Jays, you know, can't hang as a starter. Look, you know, he's Joe Biagini. It's... you get what I'm not trying to shit on, you know, the value of having a guy like that, especially when he was really good part of the bullpen. But you're not, you're really sort of fetishizing marginal value if you're getting bent out of shape about the rule five here. And speaking of Romano in particular, allow me to just read what Langenhagen wrote about him. Romano is a 25-year-old righty who spent 2018 in Double A. He's a strike throwing righty with a fastball in the 91 to 93 range. He has an average slider and changeup, both of which reside in the 80 to 84 range. His command is advanced enough that both his secondary pitches play up a little bit. He likely profiles as a fifth starter or rotation depth, but the Rangers' current pitching situation is quite precarious, and Romano may just end up sticking around to eat innings with the hope that he sticks as a back-end starter or swingman when they're competitive once again. Like, holy shit, how dare the Blue Jays allow that piece to wriggle out of their fucking grasp?
You need those guys,
I mean,
sir.
You do.
You need 2018 Josh Towers. You gotta have.
Like you do, and again, not to shit on Romano, but I mean, it's just these guys. It feels to me like a lot of guys where, you know, someone's gonna be on waivers sooner or later who won't be all that different from the guys you just lost. So. I know that people who get into the weeds of the prospects and the farm system and you know, dream on the upside are not happy about watching guys just go. I'm sure I think in Shai's piece, the player development guys for the Jays were kind of dejected, apparently, that these guys that they were kind of hoping, obviously, you know, if they thought they were going to get selected, they possibly would have put them on the 40-man, but they may have been... too hopeful that they weren't going to get taken, but I mean, we're not talking about, you know, super meaningful pieces here. I mean, nope. It's not to hand wave and all that stuff away. Obviously, mm-hmm. We spend a lot of time talking about the margins of the roster, but you know, I don't know. Come on,
Romano was the name around that non-tender 40-man deadline that those who do spend an inordinate amount of time on the margins of the roster. Were concerned about, and that was a name that people were surprised wasn't added. So, and I can understand why that maybe the player development people within the club are dejected, because those are the kind of guys that they have maybe more of an investment in, because they if ever there was a you know, the type of player who was going through development, the kind, not some guy who's blessed with the throwing, can throw 98 no matter what, and is always going to force his way to the big leagues. If this is a guy who was taking to instruction, taking to development, learning and trying to get better and getting better, and then, you can see he was down the road.
He's working out at Skydome with Ryan Barucki, apparently, when he got the call. They were workout buddies up here. So I think they did like him a bit.
No doubt. So, I mean, we wish him the best of luck. And Elvis Luciano, it would be awesome if he became another Rule 5 success story, because those stories are fun. Jose Bautista is a Rule 5 success story in his own way.
Sort of, I guess, yeah.
And as the kind of pro-laborish guys, we have to be like, this is a good escape valve for these guys. They can't just live in the minor leagues forever. So get those big league checks, Jordan Romano.
Yeah.
Speaking of big league checks, Marcus Stroman and Aaron Sanchez have been getting them for a long time. Now there are rumors about them no longer receiving them from the Toronto Blue Jays. Apparently the Cincinnati Reds renewed their interest in Marcus Stroman. Those were the two big league names, other than Russell Martin, that were really bandied about here at the winter meetings. I actually saw that Dov Speed was speaking with us, saying, we don't talk about Aaron Sanchez much. And it didn't seem like there was as much conversation about him as Stroman. More teams may be interested in Stroman. Do you think that's because Marcus Stroman is a much better pitcher?
Yeah.
I think that's why, too.
And a healthier pitcher, and a pitcher with fewer question marks. I mean... You know, Sanchez hasn't been... I was surprised. I think Sanchez made 20 starts last year, which did not feel right when I looked at that number. Mm-hmm. It could be like 17. I could be confusing him with Barucki. But he pitched 100 innings, which is not a ton. But he wasn't great even when he was healthy, even when, you know, he was sort of working past the blister thing. But it's been, you know, it's been a couple years of not great Aaron Sanchez. He was so good in 2016, I think, of course, you're going to talk about Stroman, because even as bad as his overall numbers looked last year, If you take out the part of the year when he tried to pitch through the whatever shoulder thing was going on and he went on the DL for a bit, he came back and he had like 12, 13 starts where the ERA wasn't great because he had fucking butchers in the field behind him, most likely, which is what he relies on, which is why he's not going to get, you know, a James Paxton package, because Paxton will actually, you know, I think Stroman can miss bats, but he just sort of doesn't, or, you know, I don't know. But if you look at the peripherals, if you look at the the ground ball rate, the walks, strikeouts, the FIP, sort of stuff like that, he looked like Marcus Stroman. I mean, Mark Stroman's a valuable pitcher. We know what it is. And I mean, I think if you think that he's healthy, which he was, I mean, the end of the season problem was a blister, which he's been dealing with those for a while and been a completely effective pitcher while doing so. If I'm a team, I'm pretty comfortable trading something significant for Marcus Stroman and thinking that, yeah, Marcus Stroman is going to give me a Marcus Stroman-esque year, which is probably going to be quite a bit better than, you know, the way that his 2018 worked out. Aaron Sanchez, I'm not nearly as comfortable with that.
If you trade for Marcus Stroman, you feel like your team is better. Immediately better.
Yeah.
There's a good chance that he is better than the vast majority of pitchers on your roster.
Yeah.
Aaron Sanchez is a question mark. I think you said you've nailed that exactly. And I saw, you know, as I mentioned, the Dow was saying, like, we don't talk about Sanchez much. And Ty Berry, who's a good, loyal Blue Jays Twitter soldier, made a good point, was like, you know, the dirty little secret about Aaron Sanchez is essentially that he's never, ever, ever been able to throw strikes. He had 1.5 years that he won in the bullpen, one as a starter, when he could throw strikes. And every other point of his career, he's really, really, really struggled to do that.
Yep.
You just don't know what you're going to get. And the injury thing, like as we started talking about Troy Tulowitzki, that doesn't make it any easier. That only adds question marks and adds, you know, depreciates him as a potential trade asset. If you're the Blue Jays, again, if I'm the Blue Jays, I would much rather keep Stroman because I like him better as a pitcher. I think that the fact that he has more personality and he is more out there, I think there's value in that. Not necessarily like over, you know, it makes it easier to get behind him.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing with Sanchez, though, I don't want to trade him now because, A, he's at the bottom of his value, and there's no harm in letting him go out there and hopefully make 30 start, and then you can figure out where you are with him at the end of 2019. Is he a piece of the next good Blue Jays team? Given his spotty track record, given the history with the team, they drafted him out of high school, maybe you can get a couple of extra years from him for a little bit less. If you want him to be around, if you believe in what you say, if you see something good in 2019, or maybe you're starting to look at ways to get out of the Aaron Sanchez business if you have another year like last year, because it's just like, well, what are we doing here? He's going to get a raise just based on his experience level, so I don't know.
Yeah, well, he should get a raise based on the number of starts he makes next year, because he should be their opener. Just give him a couple innings off the top. Just, you know, rear back, do what you did when you were in the bullpen, walk everybody up to start the game, and then, you know, leave it to the soft-tossing lefties that they have way too many of.
That's exciting. Well, maybe you've now helped to transition into the Charlie Montoyo kind of presser luncheon dinner thing with all of the writers. He mentioned maybe bringing over some Rays stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about what sort of make of his comment?
Well, Atkins kind of walked it back a bit, didn't he? Like, I mean, Montoyo seemed a little more enthusiastic about the opener idea than I think Atkins did, which was, you know, whatever. I don't know. Maybe the people are really looking to run with the, hey, he's from the Rays, so they did openers, he's going to want to do it here. Thing, though, I think if you look at, you know, some of the starters that the Blue Jays intend on running out there, you might be served well by having, you know, fucking a Aaron Sanchez come in, or a Ken Giles, or a Tapera, or some hard throwing right hander and come in. I mean, Baraki did great for, you know, on his own, but have guys come in ahead of Sam Gaviglio or Pinon or Sean Reed Foley, who obviously, you know, has trouble so far turning over lineups. Though he's probably going to be a Buffalo anyway, so it's Pinone, I would guess. But you know, maybe that you could see how that could perhaps work to their advantage, you know, competitively. And so I think it is a real thing that people want to talk about and are interested in. And, you know, I don't know. I could see them trying it, even though Atkins kind of was like, well, we're looking for, we really want 12 starters who can each go, you know, 8 innings deep. It's like, cool. Good luck with that.
I think my question then is this. What is the end game of the opener? If you're the Rays, say, it is a money-saving
game. Yeah,
it is hanging your players in limbo to limit the amount of arb reward that they will get. But you mentioned from a competitive standpoint, it's like, okay, so are you trying to wring as many meaningless wins out of an otherwise ordinary team? And if you think that having a starter do an opener going 25 or 30 or however many times they did it this year with Ryan Stanek and guys like that, like, what does that do? So if you're say is it a matter of development? So if you take Thomas Pannone or Baruchy or one of the other, as you mentioned, soft tossing lefties, and if you let them turn over or at least go once through the lineup, but starting them with the middle or the back half of the lineup, like, is there an end game to that? Is this just how this guy's big league career with your team is going to go? Or are these guys going to graduate into being real starters? I don't know the answer to that. The Rays signed Charlie Morton to a 2-year deal. They have 3 decent starters with Tyler Glasnow and
Snell.
And Blake Snell won the goddamn Cy Young.
Yeah.
And and then Morton. But, like, are these, like, Yarborough and all these other dudes, are they going to become real starters? Are they going to give them that opportunity? Or are they going to just keep doing this, trying to win 88 games so they can proudly say, like, aha, you thought we were going to be a disgrace. Instead, we were just merely pointless in our existence. Like, I don't know the answer to that. And is it damning these players in terms of development by trying to, like, cushion the blow of the difficulty of their job? I don't know the answer. I'm looking to you, hoping that you have it for me.
I don't know that. I don't think I have the answer, but I think it could be looked at the other way in terms of development. The cushion is maybe good for, like I say, look at the starters the Blue Jays have. I mean, maybe you don't want to throw a Reed Foley to the Wolves right away because he's had so much trouble, you know, keeping his pitch count down. You know, kind of doing the five and dive thing, and so maybe giving him a little bit of an easier time, you know, while still having him face a bunch of big league hitters and turn lineups over, and just being a little, you know, having the ability to, you know, you get 5-6 innings out of him, and you're into the seventh. It's you know, because he had someone go in front of him. Maybe it's, you know, maybe it's an easier way to break in a starter, and maybe that's what happens. I mean, we're sort of new into this phenomenon. But yeah, maybe there are guys who can prove themselves valuable enough to take the training wheels off at some point. So, you know, I there's that aspect of it, and I think that there may also be an aspect of it where, and I'm just making this up, so maybe this is wrong, but you know, the Jays have talked about, and Atkins has talked about, you know, the importance of winning at the minor league level. You know, I mean, I know you're not wrong about pointless wins and pointlessly getting to 88 wins, but I think that they...
Pointless for the Rays. It's pointless for the Rays. Sure. Not the Jays. The Rays. Because sure. They're Rays are pointless.
Sure. But, I mean, I think that the Jays, just based on that sort of posture with the minor league teams, just based on, you know, the way that they seem to value having, you know, the Fisher Cats in the Eastern League playoffs, or having, you know, making sure Guerrero and Bichette are playing for Dunedin in the Florida State League Championship, and you know, thinking about, you know, not to sound like the new agey bullshit that they you know will say themselves, but, you know, just thinking about how to win and what it takes to win, and that, you know, maybe no matter how you do it at the start of the game, maybe they see value in trying to eke out as many wins as they can, and not, you know, and be, you know, be out there trying to win ball games right off the hop, and not just writing off the idea and being like, this is a development year, treat it like the minor leagues, which they don't even treat the minor leagues like the minor leagues. They want to win those games too, to, you know, whatever extent that, that they're, you know, the their plans for certain players allow. So I, you know, I don't know. Maybe they see that there's value in that. I could see somebody making an argument that, you know, there's value in having a young team that, you know, is in as many ball games as possible, that is coming down to the wire in as many ball games as possible, that is facing pressure like that at the big league level, facing, you know, other, you know, whether the Jays won't be in a playoff race, but a lot of the teams that they'll face, or some of the teams they'll face, will be. And bringing in great relievers and bringing in, you know, using strategies that are trying to win ball games. Like, I think that that is something that they may see as a valuable thing for, you know, the future and for getting these guys into the right mindset for where they want to be 2-3 years from now.
Have you seen the movie Sicario? The Taylor Sheridan wrote and directed by Danny Villeneuve, I think. There's a line at the end. If you haven't seen it, I won't necessarily spoil it, but like,
it's okay.
You will not, there's a line at the end, like talking with somebody, you will not survive here. You are not a wolf, and this is a land of wolves now. And I can't help but think about that when it's like, oh, well, you know, maybe we'll use these guys who are marginally decent players, and it might help us win big league games. But like, they play in the American League East. The Yankees hit more home runs than literally any team has ever hit. Hiding Mookie Betts from Thomas Pannone doesn't make him any easier to get out next year.
Right.
Like that is the nature of the beast. They're not playing in the American League Central, which is a glorified international league. Like, to win games against those two teams in particular, and then the infernal blasted Rays, who have this ability to turn guys into league average bats, that is admirable and also maddening. But like, if you want your team to be good, I think you have to be really good and compete like toe to toe with those teams. You need guys that can do that. And Marcus Stroman and Aaron Sanchez, for example, when the Blue Jays won in 2016, when they won ball games, and then when they won all kinds of games in 2015, they could do that. They weren't hiding those guys from anybody. They weren't trying to soften the blow from the fact that their job is really, really hard. It's a hard job to be a big league pitcher and turn over lineups, but guys can do it. And I think that challenging them to do it is an important thing. And I'd like to see it more, as opposed to being like, man, maybe we'll cheat around. And like, the starter thing worked for them because they had good pitchers. And I think you've touched on that. And having good pitchers, having as many good pitchers as you can get is important, and the order in which they pitch doesn't necessarily matter. I do still believe that having the best pitcher, the guy who can do the hardest job, getting as many of those guys is still important. And we'll see what happens in 2019. And it's not that I'm rooting for the Rays to fail, but I'm so very much rooting for the Rays to fail across the board.
Fair.
Because they make me crazy. But anyway, so I don't know, that's a good, I don't know, I really like Sicario, by the way. I've seen the movie like so many times now.
Sir, there's a new one. Is it out?
Never happened. Nope.
No?
Okay. Nope.
Okay.
If Taylor Sheridan didn't write it, then it's not a real, I don't want Fair. Anything to do with it. Taylor Sheridan's IMDb page is quite delightful. It includes one of my favorite movies I've watched probably in the last couple of years, which is Hell or High Water. I think he wrote and directed it, or did he just write it? I'm gonna look now. Is this really what people care about an hour into this? No, he wrote it. David McKenzie directed Hell or High Water. Unbelievable! Such a good movie. Such a good movie. That's the movie that's like pretty much the only thing we talk about in G chat now. The group chat with like Parks and Lewis and Richard. We talk about Hell or High Water and Taylor Sheridan movies. Because that's just the kind of dorks that we are. Middle-aged dork, also, by the way. I think that's about it. Is there anything else you want to talk about? Justin Smoke's in the trade of the Rockies?
Sure. No, give him Kevin Pillar, too. Give us John Gray. There we go. Done. Trade.
You know what I would wish? And I don't know if I said this last week. Why the fuck don't the Rockies just go sign Bryce Harper? Honestly. Yeah. Sign it. Don't operate your team like a joke. Do you know what kind of numbers Bryce Harper would put up playing in Colorado every day? It would be astounding. Although he is already quite injury prone, and adding that to the mix, not recommended. But I think they got to do it. And then he could play first base, or Dickerson could play first base, or Blackman, or not Dickerson, Blackman could play first base. I don't care.
Blackman figure it out. First base, yeah. The guy they signed to be their center fielder a year ago. Yeah, better move him to first base. Those Rockies, whenever they dish out a ton of money, it does seem to work out quite well, doesn't it?
Look, are they going to re-sign Arenado? Why not just get into it already now? Yeah, you're competing with the Dodgers, you're competing with the Giants who spend money, who are not in a good place right now. But like, just do it. Just go sign Bryce Harper, Colorado. I don't care about the Rockies. I just want to see Bryce Harper hit in Colorado all the time. How good would that be? He would look like a regular Troy Tulowitzki out there.
the Giants. A big JP Ricciardi signing there. That's a big move for them. I'm really looking forward to seeing how that works out.
You know, he has a commendable track record. Without JP Ricciardi, there is no Noah Syndergaard.
Where would the Mets be without him? Yeah,
exactly. Jay Happ gone back to the Yankees 2 years with an option that's based on appearances. Good for him. 36 years old, got a 3-year deal. After signing identical to the one he signed 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, as a 3-year older player, I think that's great. I'm happy for J-Hat.
I don't know that it's basically a 3-year. I mean, it's a vesting option based on innings and starts in 2020. We'll kick that option in, and I think, I don't know if it was like 170 and 24 starts, or there were like,
I recall it being much less than that.
Less than that? Okay.
Right. When I glanced at it, it seemed achievable, but you know, everything does. But yeah, I don't know. Good for him. And then Messiero got traded. We talked about this ever so briefly. He played for Seattle for a while until they trade him.
They'll trade him before the end of the winter, right? No.
Well, maybe they'll let him. He wasn't super great last year, was he?
No.
He's no Kendrys Morales, but who is?
Yeah, I think Morales was having a better year until September when Morales fucking tanked my bet. Really did not have a good September. But I think Encarnacion had 32 home runs and, you know, a bunch of RBIs, if that's the kind of thing that floats your boat. But there's a guy I wouldn't mind seeing him fucking crushing bombs in Colorado.
Yeah, that's true. But they don't have a DH. He's a first baseman. Hey, hold on.
You're right?
DePoto, get on the phone. I'm sure he's already there. Make a trade from a hospital bed.
Jesus Christ. Yeah.
I think that's about it. We've been going on for a long time. We know this, the Witch meetings. Even though nothing happened, some stuff happened.
Yeah.
And now we wait. And there's still so many good big free agent pieces to fall. There are still some decisions to make. So... you got anything to plug? You got anything to add?
No, not really.
All right, so I'm sure we'll take a little bit of a break over the holidays, but we'll be back next week, right?
I'm game, yeah.
All right, we'll do it next week. So, of course, if you like what you hear, you can head over to patreon.com/birdsallday and support the podcast, keep us going. Thank you to everyone who's been doing so over the years. We really appreciate it. Keeps us going, keeps us honest. It's 1:30 in the morning right now, and we're doing it, and that is purely the reason why.
exactly.
Because I would be in bed, but I'm not.
And I would be at the bar.
Yeah, that's true as well. You were asleep, and now. Anyway, but here we are. So thank you to everybody who supports the show. Thank you to everyone who supports us and shares the stuff that we read, the stuff that we talk about online. We're very thankful. And so, yeah, if you want to support the show, you can do that over there. If you want to subscribe, you can do it. However, last week I had a bit of a challenge with some audio issues. So thanks everybody to reported that to us. It seemed like Google Play was the kind of common denominator in terms of it didn't replace the file after the audio issue.
Yeah, I uploaded the wrong file to SoundCloud. It was just because Drew sends me his audio and I cut everything together because that's the kind of sophisticated operation we're running here. I literally immediately recognized that it was not the right file and changed it on SoundCloud, but... Google Play did not pick up the change as quickly as literally everywhere else. So I'd like to invite the Google people to a congressional hearing, ask them about my iPhone.
That was one of the more agonizing things I've ever seen. Also, reminding you of your iPhone, that, we got a lot of response to the screen time conversation.
Oh, yeah.
People asking what app we use, and I don't know if I mentioned the show, but it is just built into iOS. Also, this last week has been a complete nightmare for my screen time. Even though I'm hyper aware of it, it has somehow become worse. The numbers are not good this week. Today was a rough day. Anytime there's any little changes to the routine, just open it up. Yesterday I had to do a different commute home. I was on a GO train ever so briefly, just throwing my numbers way off, and I'm in pain. I'm in agony looking at this average time creep up. There's no way I'm going to get under this week. It's really bad. But thank you for everyone for sharing and commiserating in our screen time challenges that are afflicting an entire generation of people, I think.
I think so, yeah. I think so.
Don't look at the bad screen at work. Let's look at the good screen at home. And look at the good screen when you get the notification that there's a new episode of Birds All Day. So you can head us up on Facebook as well. You can read Stoughton at The Athletic. You can read me. I wrote something on Vice about Troy Tulowitzki that Stoughton was kind said nice things about. So go find that. And in the meantime, we will say thank you, and we'll talk to you again soon next week on Birds All Day.